It is upon principle Mr. McVeigh has decided to seek court relief, and it is based upon the government's failure to produce evidence in his case. He is convinced that the Department of Justice and the FBI will not otherwise be held to account unless he takes this action.
Attorney Robert Nye speaking Thursday from Terre Haute, Indiana. Timothy McVeigh is scheduled to die later this month for his role in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. Mr. Nye and Timothy McVeigh's other lawyers are hoping to delay that execution. In the meantime, federal jurors in Manhattan are considering the death penalty for a man convicted this week for the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Kenya. Dan Shore is away this week, so our friend John Heilman of Wired Magazine joins us from is it San Francisco or New York, John?
New York today, Scott.
New York today. Well, nice to talk to you again.
Always great to be here.
Look, Tim McVeigh was willing, and even if I might put it this way, almost eager to be executed. But he now says that 4,000 pages of evidence the FBI failed to turn over amounts to a fraud. Is there really a chance that because of that error, locking off other possibilities for the moment, this whole emotional, extraordinary case could be opened up?
I think there's a reasonable chance. Yes, Scott. I mean, it's not guaranteed at all. I mean, I think that what is pretty clear is that when McVeigh and his lawyers go into court and ask for this delay, that they are going to get it. They are going to say that they haven't had a chance to review the new evidence. They are also going to say that they don't even think they have all of the evidence still, that the FBI is still holding back some amount of its investigative material. And they will probably, as I say, they'll get that delay. The big question, though, is whether they will get what they ultimately, I think, want, which is a new trial. And that depends a lot on motivation. I mean, they will need not just to show that they have not had time to review the new evidence, but they'll need to show that the FBI withheld that information intentionally, or that it has some real effect on McVeigh's guilt. Now, we know that that's not the case, not just because the FBI and the DOJ say so, but because McVeigh, of course, has already admitted that he is the person who blew up the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. So we know that there's no chance that it's going to change whether or not he's actually guilty or innocent. But there is a chance that we can find out that the FBI was keeping this material back intentionally, as opposed to what it now claims, which is that it was all a big mistake. And if there's some evidence that the FBI was withholding information intentionally, then it's a whole new ballgame, and you're looking at a new trial for sure.
Well, that brings up the matter of Timothy McVeigh's motivation, because when he was saying, take me now, no appeals, that at least had the virtue of consistency. Why the change of mind now?
Well, I mean, I think that it's certainly clear that McVeigh's lawyers are outraged by the way they've been actually treated in this case, and mm-hmm. that, when they say these things, like Tim McVeigh is now fighting for principle and the integrity of the U.S. justice system, I mean, one does want to cast a bit of a jaundiced eye on that. But, you know, whatever their motivations are, I actually think it's probably sort of a good thing that they continue to press this case, because the truth is that the FBI has, whether through gross incompetence or through intentional malfeasance, they've behaved abominably in this case. It's an incredibly high profile, an incredibly important case in which you would think that they would have given the closest attention to all these details. And instead, we find ourselves in the middle of this mess. And there's really no one whose fault. No one to blame there except for Louis Freeh and the FBI.
Well, let me ask you, how does this FBI mess, if you please, affect the larger debate going on in this country now about the death penalty at a time when mistakes made in capital cases are prompting even some advocates of the death penalty to call for a review of what is, after all, the ultimate irreversible penalty?
Right. Well, it's a remarkable time, actually. You know, it's the first time in memory that it seems like the anti-death penalty forces actually have the momentum on their side. I mean, part of that has to do with the fact that the crime rate is so low. We saw violent crime statistics again this week that showed that after several years of unprecedented consistent falls in the violent crime rate, it's flat again this year. So there is a sense in which the time when the death penalty was most popular, of course, when violent crime was raging, that has created a context in which people have been able to ask serious questions. But the thing that has really got people asking the serious questions is things just like this FBI screw-up, which is that in state after state, we're finding out that the methods by which people are put to death are really quite defective, and that the system by which this happens, the ultimate sanction is imposed, turns out to be pretty dodgy. And as you've seen that happen in state after state, you've seen the momentum for reform build, and I think this will only add to that.
John, the week ahead, Democratic Party takes control of the Senate. Any signs you saw this week about the change even before the swearing-in takes place?
Well, yes, sir. I mean, the Democrats have stomped onto the public stage and said it's a whole new ballgame, George Bush. It's a whole new ballgame, Republicans. You had, you know, the new Democratic committee chairs in the Senate coming out and basically saying, you know, the Bush administration's agenda is no longer anything like a slam dunk, and in some cases, it's probably dead. You had Carl Levin, the new chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, basically saying, oh, yeah, that missile shield that you're all so excited about, forget about that, guys. We're going back to the Clinton administration's position, which was, yeah, nice idea. We'll keep spending some money on it, but no time soon. Mm-hmm. You had Tom Daschle go on TV last week and basically say, you know, drilling in the Arctic wildlife preserve, dead, not happening. So I think you're going to see it's a very dramatic change. And now this weekend, you've got John McCain, always a thorn in the Bush administration's side. He's flying down to spend the weekend, or he has Tom Daschle, the new Senate Majority Leader, flying down to visit him at his vacation place in Arizona over the weekend. They're going to eat some barbecue along with the head of the Democratic Leadership Council. So the whole political calculus in Washington is up for grabs.
Well, eat some barbecue, but I wonder if at the same time they're also going to be, you know, eating the bones of the Republican Party as far as Mr. McCain is concerned. Do you think there is really a chance that he's going to become an independent?
Well, I think that that John McCain is obviously someone who has both enormous personal ambition and political ambition, and someone who the Bush administration has done a terrible job trying to keep on side from the very beginning. The personal relations between the two are very poor. Mm-hmm. And it's on the questions of policy and ideology, where Bush kind of governed as a moderate or campaigned as a moderate and has tried to govern from the far right. You've got McCain, who really sort of thinks that the future of the Republican Party is much closer to the center. And so you've got a long-term problem there. Whether that means McCain will actually switch parties or not, I don't know. But the real issue is that he's an incredibly important, powerful force in American politics. And this change in the Senate only gives him more power rather than less.
John, the United Kingdom votes this week, federal parliamentary elections. Labour Party, headed by Tony Blair, is expected to win handily, despite hoof and mouth, despite public dissatisfaction with many public conveyances. What do you make of the issues there and what this election is going to say?
Well, I think that Tony Blair is a guy who, if you read the British press, you will hear that he's sanctimonious, that he's the bloom is off the rose, that he's been very disappointing, he's pompous and self-righteous. But the truth is that the British public
you ought to come on this show someday.
Scott, you'd put him in his place. I know you would.
Wouldn't get a word in.
Tony, I've heard he's afraid of you, actually. He's quaking in his boots. But, you know, he's done gotten a couple things incredibly right. He's gotten the economy very right. He's managed the economy as well as anybody in any Western democracy in the past 4 years. He's got foreign policy, very delicate, trying to play to be constructive both with the Europeans and with the Americans. He's got that right. And he's done incredible things in terms of constitutional reform, devolving power to England, to Scotland and Wales and Northern Ireland. He's talked about reforming the House of Lords, elected a mayor in London. Mm-hmm. He's popular with good reason. He's done a really good job, and people in Britain, I think, have a sense that that's true.
Yeah, and William Hague, the Tory leader, if he's defeated as badly as it seems, do you expect there'll be another Tory leader?
I do. Michael Portillo, I think, will be the man, and William Hague, a very intelligent, very competent guy with great instincts, will not be heard from again.
Okay, John, thank you very much.
Sure thing, Scott.
Our friend
great to be here.
John Heilemann from Wired Magazine, speaking from New York.